of persons throwing off the demonic captivity that they're under and scattering their enemies by the victory that God will bring them if they trust in Him instead of in their flesh. Verse 23 says, "Then shall He give the rain of thy seed, and thou shalt sow the ground withal, and bread of the increase of the earth, and it shall be fat and plenteous. In that day shall thy cattle feed in large pastures. The oxen likewise, and the young asses that ear the ground, shall eat clean provender, which hath been winnowed with the shovel and with the fan. And there shall be upon every high mountain and upon every high hill rivers and streams of waters in the day of the great slaughter, when the towers fall." Now this apparently means the towers of the enemy fortresses will fall, and the reference to rivers of water in all the high mountains probably is not to be taken as literal. Rivers will come out on every mountain on the world, but rather just saying there will be an abundant supply of water and bread. He talks about how in verse 23 the bread of the increase of the earth shall be fat and plenteous. Well, a little earlier he said in verse 20, "Though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction." In other words, when God chastens His people, it is said they're eating the bread of affliction or the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. Yet when His blessing comes upon them, they'll eat the bread of fatness and plenteousness, and water will come abundantly from every hill. The idea being that God will pour out an abundance of those things that are needed for our sustenance in the final end. And that'll be in the day when the towers fall. That's the day where the final victory is complete and our warfare is accomplished and every stronghold that exalts itself against the knowledge of God is cast down. "Moreover, the light of the moon shall be as the light of the sun. The light of the sun shall be sevenfold as the light of 7 days in the day that the Lord bindeth up the breach of His people and heals the stroke of their wound." I've heard this verse used by those who take the scriptures absolutely literally to suggest that in the last days this will literally happen. The moon will be as bright as the sun, and the sun will be 7 times as strong. And they usually try to associate that with the breakup of the ozone layer or something like that, you know, and they're trying to see that as a judgment in the tribulation period or something. And that is far from being what is described here. If the sun was literally 7 times hotter than it is now, this planet would melt. I mean, there would be no life sustained. I mean, this would be a description of a tremendous curse that God would bring on and a great punishment. But it's the opposite. This is a figurative description of blessing. Remember in the earlier chapters when judgments were brought on nations, what happened? The sun was darkened as far as they were concerned. For instance, in the judgment of Babylon in Isaiah 13:10, it says, "For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine." In other words, when a judgment is proclaimed in the Hebrew poetic language form, many times it is described as though the sun's going out on these people. The moon doesn't shine for them anymore. The sun doesn't shine. Those things which are the most essential to our survival, like sunlight, are going to be withdrawn from these people. It's a figurative description of judgment of God coming on people in their destruction. So what is it when he says the light of the moon shall be brighter and the light of the sun shall be 7 times as much? It's equally figurative, and it's giving the opposite impression. Just as the total judgment of God is depicted as the sun being darkened and the moon not giving her light, so the total blessing of God is considered to be God increasing the light of the sun and the moon on His people. It certainly not be a blessing to the people of God if the sun was literally 7 times hotter than it is now. But that's not what's implied. This is a description of blessing, not a description of judgment. In the context, he's saying that he's going to bless the people with plenty of grain, plenty of water, plenty of light, plenty of teachers, everything they need for life and godliness. And I have very little doubt that this applies to the life under the new covenant at the present time, although it could perhaps refer to things that happen after Jesus comes back. One thing it does not mean, I'm quite confident, is it does not mean that there's going to be a literal increase in the brightness of the sun and the moon. That would be quite out of context with the passage, and certainly does not take into consideration the regular images that the prophets use, where they involve descriptions of the light of the sun and the moon. Now, in verse 27, the subject changes, as it often does in Isaiah, but it's related. He begins to proclaim the judgment upon the Assyrians. Actually, verse 27 and 28 is talking about how the Assyrians will sweep in like a flood, and he repeats what he said earlier, how that they will come up to the neck. That was also said, remember, in chapter 8 and verse 8, how that the Assyrians would sweep in, and they'd come even to the neck, meaning that all of Judah would be covered by the Assyrian armies except the head, which is Jerusalem. Jerusalem would be, you know, it's like they're neck deep in this flood of armies that have come against them. The head, the only thing that's above the water is the city of Jerusalem with its walls. It's besieged. Everything else is inundated. That's the imagery being used here. In verses 27 and 28, it speaks of the Assyrians coming in like this flood. But then in verses 29 through 33, it talks about God bringing his judgment on the Assyrians, which we know was fulfilled when the angel of the Lord went among them and smote them. But it says, "Behold, the name of the Lord cometh from far, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, and his tongue is as a devouring fire." This is not literal. God's tongue is not like a fire, literally, and so forth. It's, these are judgment motifs that are being used. In this case, it's his anger against Jerusalem by bringing in the Assyrians. But then at verse 29, it changes over and shows that after he's accomplished his will using the Assyrians, he will then judge them too. Verse 28 says, "His breath is as an overflowing stream, shall reach to the midst of the neck." That reminds us of chapter 8, verse 8, where the Assyrian armies would come even to the neck. "To sift the nations with the sieve of vanity, and there shall be a bridle in the jaws of the people, causing them to err." Now this is God judging the nations, apparently by the Assyrian conquests of the world at that time. "Ye shall have a song, and it as in the night when the holy solemnity is kept, in gladness of heart, as when one goeth with a pipe to come into the mountain of the Lord, to the mighty one of Israel. And the Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard, and shall show the lightning, the lighting down of his arm, with the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of a devouring fire, with scattering and tempest and hailstones." Again, these are more judgment motifs that we've already encountered earlier. The hail, the fire, the storm, these are all things that have come up earlier. They're not used literally. For instance, in chapter 29 and verse 6, when he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem or the judgment coming on Jerusalem, it says, "Thou shalt be visited of the Lord of hosts with thunder, with earthquake, with great noise, with storm and tempest and flames and devouring fire." These are all just images of judgment, which, of course, the book of Revelation picks up and uses a great deal, all of these same images of judgment. They are not generally to be understood literally. It was not with hailstones or with a storm that God judged the Assyrians or Judah. It was actually with military might in the case of Judah, and with an angel in the case of Assyria. So realize that when we see this kind of language, we're using the prophet's using typical Hebrew language to describe judgment, but he's not really describing the mode of judgment. And when we, for instance, see in Ezekiel 38 and 39 about how Gog and Magog come against the beloved city, and hail and brimstone and fire from heaven devour Gog and Magog, many people take that absolutely literally. And they think that Russia is going to march on to Israel, and then God's going to send fire and brimstone out of heaven and destroy Russia. 5/6 of their armies will be destroyed. You read this in a lot of prophetic books. They, again, seem to fail to take into account that this kind of language is used consistently in the prophets in a non-literal way, but in a way that conveys the idea of supernatural judgment. That is, God is behind it. Though a judgment may come through an apparently natural means. For instance, when an army wipes out another nation, that seems to be a natural disaster as far as the nation is concerned, but God always says that he's behind it. You could see that as though it was sent from heaven when he judges a nation like that. It's as though it were hailstones or a storm or any of those other things that come directly from God. Verse 31, "And through the voice of the Lord shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. And in every place where the grounded staff shall pass, which the Lord shall lay upon him, it shall be with tabrets and with harps, and in battles of shaking will he fight with it. For Tophet is ordained of old, yea, for the king is it prepared. He hath made it deep and large. The pile thereof is fire and much wood, and the breath of the Lord, like a stream of brimstone, doth kindle it." Tophet was another name for the valley just outside of Jerusalem, which is also known as the Valley of Hinnom, spelled H-I-N-N-O-M, and it is that latter name that is more often spoken of as in the scriptures. Valley of Hinnom was at one point in the Jews' history a place where they worshipped Moloch, and they offered infant sacrifices to this heathen god. And when the Jews repented of that great sin, they transformed the Valley of Hinnom into a garbage dump. And they defiled it because it was once a place that they had offered infant sacrifices to Molech. They wanted to make sure it would never be used for such things again, so they turned it into a garbage dump where fires were burning perpetually, day and night. And also to limit the spread of germs and so forth, they would use sulfur, which is what brimstone is. Brimstone's an old word for sulfur. And they would sulfur the area, which of course would have a horrible stink to it, as sulfur does when it burns, but it was for the sake of, you know, just kind of keeping the area, I guess, sanitary or whatever. But it was a known garbage dump near Jerusalem, the Valley of Hinnom was, and it was also a place where dead bodies might be thrown, of people who were held in contempt. They'd be thrown on the garbage dump and burned there. And basically, it's saying that this valley is ordained, that is, God has ordained this valley as the place where the king, probably meaning the king of Assyria, would be dumped. Now, I don't know, but I don't think that the king of Assyria literally died at the Valley of Hinnom. I think he died in his own country. But the point here is that God is going to treat the king of Assyria with such contempt that it'd be comparable to burning him in the garbage dump. By the way, when Jesus spoke of hell in his ministry, the word that he used for hell was not Hades, as is used elsewhere in the scripture, but Jesus used the word Gehenna, which is a Hebrew expression, or Greek expression, I guess, referring to the Valley of Hinnom. When Jesus spoke of the lake of fire, when he spoke of the place where the fire is not quenched and the worm dieth not, and people being thrown into fire and brimstone, the word for hell there he used, it was Gehenna, which means the Valley of Hinnom. And so this garbage dump outside Jerusalem became the image that Jesus would use to describe what hell would be like. The fires that were always perpetually burning, and the place had a foul smell to it, and it was a place of total, disgust, really. And that's kind of the image that Jesus used, the earthly allegory for what hell would be like. And that's basically where this guy's going, this king of Assyria. He's going to hell, essentially, is what the message is here. Then in chapter 31, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, that stay on horses. Stay simply means to trust, to lean on. To stay on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord. Now, I already mentioned that Psalm 20 in verse 7 says some trust in horses and some in chariots, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. In Psalm 33 in verse 17, it says, a horse is a vain thing for safety, neither shall he deliver any by his great strength. In other words, it is an empty hope to put your trust in military armaments, he says. A horse, this is Psalm 33:17, a horse is a vain thing for safety. And as you put your trust in your horses and your chariots, and you're trusting in vain. It won't save you. We already saw Isaiah 30 and verse 16. You said, we will flee on horses. We will ride upon the swift. He says, therefore those who pursue you will be swift. So trusting in your horses is a vain hope, and it's not safe. Though it is, of course, the natural thing for nations to do who don't trust in God. It's very evident that there's not a nation on the earth that trusts in God, except the church, the body of Christ. And some of the members of it don't trust in God so much as they trust in horses and chariots either. It says, yet, verse 2, yet he also is wise and will bring evil. That is, you must think God's pretty dumb. If you think that you can thwart his efforts to bring judgment and chastisement upon you by your military strength, you must think God's pretty dumb. But guess what? He's not. He's wise. He's smarter than that. You're not going to get away with it. He is very wise, and he will bring evil, and will not call back his words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers, and against the help of them that work iniquity. Now the Egyptians are men, and not God, and their horses are flesh, not spirit. When the Lord shall stretch out his hand, both he that helps shall fall, and he that is helped shall fall down, and they all shall fail together. In other words, you can trust in Egypt, and in the horses of Egypt if you want to, but they're not God. And they're not spirit, they're flesh. Therefore, when God, who is spirit, raises up his hand to judge, You can have as many helpers as you want to. The helpers and the helped will all fail together when God intervenes in the situation. If you don't look to Him, it says in Proverbs, though hand join in hand, the wicked shall not be unpunished. Meaning, let all the wicked join hands and conspire together, yet they can't avoid the punishment of the Lord. Verse 4, and thus hath the Lord spoken to me, like as the lion and the young lion roaring on his prey, when a multitude of shepherds is called forth against him, he will not be afraid of their voice, nor abase himself for the noise of them. So shall the Lord of hosts come down to fight for Mount Zion, and for the hill thereof. As birds flying, so will the Lord of hosts defend Jerusalem, defending also he will deliver it, and passing over he will preserve it. In other words, God doesn't need your military help, Egypt. God is like a lion guarding his prey. Now, what the picture here is one that the Jews would recognize very much, because many of them were shepherds. And if a lion happened to get a lamb that had wandered off from the fold, and the lion was eating it, and a whole bunch of shepherd boys came up to chase it off, once he's got his prey, he's not going to let it go. He's not going to be scared off by a few shepherd boys. He said even a multitude of shepherds. They can't drive him off. He's defensive of his prey. He's got his meal, and he's not going to give it up easy. And he says, just like a lion can't be chased off from his prey by no matter how many shepherds you bring, you're not going to chase him away from that animal that he's caught. So God can't be chased away by a multitude of armies. God's going to defend his people just like a lion defends his catch for himself. So God's going to defend Jerusalem, as it were. It doesn't matter how many shepherds or warriors or whatever are brought against him. He's going to be above them all. Like birds flying, so shall the Lord defend Jerusalem. And like birds flying, of course, means far beyond the reach of man. Man can't get at God. How's he going to fight against God? God is higher. God is more powerful. He's like a lion. He's like birds flying overhead that can't be captured or can't be... In those days, they didn't have shotguns. You know, they couldn't shoot them down. I doubt if anyone ever hit a bird with a bow and arrow as it was flying over. Maybe they did. The idea is that he's beyond their reach. And passing over it, he will preserve it. Verse 6, turn ye unto him from whom the children of Israel have deeply revolted. For in that day every man shall cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which your own hands have made unto you for a sin. Then shall the Assyrian fall by the sword, not of a mighty man, and the sword, not of a mean man, shall devour him. This is, of course, an angel that came through and slew the Assyrians. So it was not the sword of a mighty man. It wasn't an army coming against him. It was God's own angels coming against him. But he shall flee from the sword, and his young men shall be discomfited, and he shall pass over to his stronghold for fear, and his princes shall be afraid of the ensign, saith the Lord, whose fire is in Zion, and his furnace in Jerusalem. This is fulfilled in chapter 37 of Isaiah. You can read the story, how that the angel of the Lord went through, slew 185,000 Assyrians, and then the rest of the Assyrians fled in fear back to their own stronghold. And actually, the king of Assyria died there at the hands of his own sons who assassinated him. That was also predicted in another place in Isaiah. Okay, let's go on to chapter 32. We got a little bit of time. Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. Now, this reference to a king shall reign in righteousness is sometimes thought to be a passage about the Messiah. Certainly the Jews and Isaiah particularly prophesied that God would send the Messiah to be a king, and this could be a passage that speaks of him. Others feel that this is just a generic reference to the fact that after God delivers his people, there will be a general turn of events. The kings will no longer be wicked, but they'll have righteous kings instead. It could be seen either way. I prefer to see it as a passage about the Messiah. I have a feeling that if we heard the Apostle Paul teach on this passage, he'd somehow apply it to Jesus, and that wouldn't be too hard to do given the things that are said in it. Behold, a king shall reign in righteousness, and princes shall rule in judgment. And a man shall be as an hiding place from the wind, and a covert from the tempest. Remember how that the tempest was mentioned earlier as God's judgment in chapter 30 and verse 30. He said, as he was mentioning the judgment, he talked about the flame of divine fire and scattering and tempest and hailstones. When God sends judgment, the tempest is one of the things. That is a storm, like a hurricane, a powerful wind that's a destructive storm. This is one of the ways that God is seen as being in judgment. But here he says, there will be a hiding place from this tempest, from the judgment. And that hiding place will be a man. And I take that to mean that man will be Jesus. Jesus is the hiding place from the judgment of God. A man shall be as a hiding place from the wind, a covert from the tempest, as rivers of water in a dry place, as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. And the eyes of them that see shall not be dim, and the ears of them that hear shall hearken. The heart also of the rash, or in the Hebrew, the hasty. Remember, those who believe shall not make haste, it says. We already saw in chapter 28, verse 16. The heart of the hasty shall understand knowledge. That is, they will cease to be hasty because they begin to understand knowledge. And the tongue of the stammerers shall be ready to speak plainly. The vile person shall be no more called liberal or generous, nor the churl shall be said to be bountiful. For the vile person will speak villainy, and his heart will work iniquity, and practice hypocrisy, and to utter error against the Lord, to make empty the soul of the hungry. And he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. The instruments also of the churl are evil. What's the churl in a modern English translation? Anyone have one? Anyone looking at one at the moment? It comes up in verse 5 and verse 7. Scoundrel? Okay, that's essentially the impression you get from the word churl. The scoundrel, okay? The instruments also of the scoundrel, we could say, are evil. He deviseth wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaketh right. But the liberal deviseth liberal things, and the liberal things he shall stand. Now what he's saying here is when Jesus comes, when God sets things right, people who are really wicked will not be considered to be other than they are. When Jesus came, you remember, the Pharisees were considered to be so righteous, but Jesus exposed them as the biggest hypocrites there were. It's always been that way in every society, and it was that way in Isaiah's own day, that the men who were the biggest hypocrites, exploiting the poor and everything, managed to do it in ways that were legal, and ways that somehow made them seem come out smelling like a rose, even though they were doing things offensive to God. They were called liberal. Think of the case where Jesus was watching in the treasury, and a Pharisee came and gave a large sum to the treasury, and then a widow came up and gave only two mites, and he said she gave more than he did. Because he gave out of his abundance. He had more at home than he wasn't giving. She gave everything she had. What was he saying? This man appeared to be liberal. People thought, wow, what a generous man. But he was really a scoundrel. He was really a vile person. He was a rich enough man that he could give a large gift and appear to be a generous man. But Jesus could see right through him. When Jesus comes, people will not be judged according to appearances. A few religious acts outwardly done will not fool him. And in fact, he says, evil men will be seen for what they are. But the liberal, the truly generous man, in verse 8, does devise truly generous things. That is, his lifestyle will be consistent. He's not just going to have a few generous acts that he performs, but really be doing wicked things on the side. And it's by his generosity that he shall stand. Verse 8 is saying. Verse 9, rise up, ye women that are at ease. Now, the women were rebuked earlier in Isaiah. You might remember. I think it was in chapter 4, wasn't it? Or 5. It must have been chapter 5 or 6. I don't have it in my notes, but there was a passage here. I think it was chapter 5. No? Where was it? Anyone remember offhand? I'm sure I can find it. There's probably a cross-reference here. Chapter 3, sorry. In chapter 3, verses 16 through 24, there was a rebuke of the women. In verse 16, moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched out necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go and making a tinkling with their feet, therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will discover their secret parts. And so forth. It goes on to talk about their ornaments that will be thrown off. But it says in verse 24, and it shall come to pass that instead of a sweet smell there shall be stink, instead of a girdle, a tear, instead of a well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a stomacher, which was a girdle, a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. So God had a case, of course, against the men, which most of the prophecies Isaiah gave were against the men. But he also had a case against the women. The women also were no better. They tended to be overfed. They tended to be proud and arrogant. We have another prophecy about the women made by Amos, the prophet. Joel, Amos, chapter 6. Where Amos actually calls these women of Jerusalem cows and talks about them being... let me see here. Well, actually, chapter 4 and chapter 6 of Amos. In chapter 6 of Amos, in verse 1, it says, "Woe to them that are at ease in Zion." In our passage in Isaiah, it says, "Rise up, you women that are at ease." Amos says, "Woe to you who are at ease in Zion." In other words, you're living comfortably when there's really works of righteousness that ought to be done. But you're just kind of enjoying the good life, as it were. In Amos chapter 4, he calls these women cows. He says, "Hear this, you cows of Bashan, that are in the mountain of Samaria, which oppress the poor and crush the needy, which say to their husbands, 'Bring and let us drink.' The Lord God has sworn by His holiness that, lo, the day shall come upon you that He will take away with hooks, take you away with hooks, and your posterity with fish hooks. And ye shall go out at the breaches, every cow at that which is before her, and ye shall cast them into the palace, saith the Lord." Anyway, Amos the prophet does something similar to what Isaiah does. He speaks against the women who are, apparently the rich women, who are oppressing the poor. They're at ease, they're comfortable, but God's going to judge them. So also Isaiah here, in Isaiah 32:9, "Rise up, ye women that are at ease. Hear my voice, ye careless daughters. Give ear unto my speech. Many days and years shall ye be troubled, ye careless women. For the vintage shall fail, the gathering shall not come. Tremble, ye women that are at ease. Be troubled, ye careless ones. Strip you and make you bare, and gird sackcloth upon your loins." In other words, take off all your fancy garments, which you're so proud of, and put on the garments of mourning. Sackcloth is what they would wear when they were repenting and mourning over their sins. "They shall lament for the teats, for the pleasant fields, for the fruitful vine. Upon the land of my people shall come up thorns and briars, yea, upon all the houses of joy in the joyous city, because the palaces shall be forsaken, the multitude of the city shall be left, the forts and towers shall be for dens forever." That is, they'll be broken down and used by wild animals for places to live. "A joy of wild asses and a pasture of flocks, until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field, and the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness, and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. When it shall hail, coming down on the forest, the city shall be low in a low place. Blessed are ye that sow beside all waters, that send forth thither the feet of the ox and the ass." Well, some of these lines I can't interpret for you very easily, but there's a general reference here, I believe, to the coming of the new covenant. When he says in verse 15, "until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high," this would appear to refer to Acts chapter 2, when the Holy Spirit was poured out on the day of Pentecost upon the remnant of Israel. Some 3,000 were saved on that day and received the Spirit. What's saying here is that there will be judgment upon Israel until that time, until the Spirit is poured out. The women who are so proud are going to have trouble. Many days of trouble, it says. What's it say? "Many days and years shall you be troubled," in verse 10, "you careless women." So there's going to be a period of many days and years where the Israel is troubled. But it will basically... the dealings of God upon them will come to the climax, and perhaps we could say to an end, at the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit is poured out from on high. Now notice, and notice it now for the sake of later passages that we'll see, it describes what happens at the day of Pentecost as the wilderness will be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field will be counted for a forest. Now, the wilderness to become a fruitful field speaks of that which was formerly fruitless will become fruitful. The wilderness, of course, is uncultivated land, not producing any fruit. Remember how often fruit is an issue in the book of Isaiah. They were a vineyard that didn't produce fruit. And God was looking for fruit from Israel. Well, he says, they're like a wilderness now, but they will become fruitful. That is with fruit of the Spirit. When the Spirit is poured out, they who had been fruitless will begin to bear fruit. And when it says the fruitful field will be counted as a forest, this probably has at least a double meaning, because earlier we saw in chapter 29 in verse 17, is it not yet a very little while and Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field should be esteemed as a forest. And as I pointed out at that time, that this is reference to a proverb that spoke of Lebanon, which was forested, being changed into a fruitful field, which in the Hebrew the word is Carmel. Carmel was another place that was a fruitful field. And Carmel will be turned into a forest. It's like things will be reversed. Everything's going to be turned upside down when the Lord brings about his final work, which is the new covenant. Everything was turned upside down. The Carmel became a forest and Lebanon became a fruitful field. Not literally, but basically the changes that God brought about were as radical. It was as much an upheaval as if those things, like the forested Lebanon, became something totally different than they are. And he seems to be identifying the pouring out of the Spirit on his people as that time that he spoke of earlier, as the fruitful field becoming a forest. But he's speaking of it at also a time when his people become fruitful. Several of the images from earlier in the book are brought in here and brought into the new covenant promises here with the Spirit being poured out. When it says, then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness and righteousness shall remain in the fruitful field. Remember, judgment and righteousness, which are mentioned in this verse, were the two things that God said he was looking for from his vineyard in chapter 5. The fruit he was looking for was judgment and righteousness. And he didn't find it, so what was he going to do? He's going to tear down the hedge and let the vineyard become a wilderness. But now he says, that which had become a wilderness was now going to become fruitful. God had brought judgment on Israel, but now he's going to pour out his Spirit on the remnant of them. And that which he had made into a wilderness was now going to start producing the very fruit that they were supposed to produce before. Now, wilderness here could also refer to Gentile nations. And the reason I say that is because wilderness is a picture of whatever is unfruitful. And the Gentiles were considered to be unfruitful nations. And we see that image coming up in Isaiah 54. Chapter 54 and verse 1 says, sing, O barren, that did not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud that did not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord. What's that talking about? It's talking about the same thing. It's talking about Gentiles who had never borne children for God will now bear more children for God than the married wife Israel does. And the reason I know it's saying that is because Paul quoted this in Galatians 4 and he made that application to it. It's in Galatians 4 verse 27 that Paul quotes this verse. And he essentially uses it this way, that the Gentile nations, which had been barren toward God, that is, they never brought forth fruit of the womb, they never brought forth children for God, eventually they will have cause to sing because they will produce more children for God than the Jews, who are the married wife, do. So the predictions of Isaiah, at least in chapter 54 and verse 1, say that the Gentiles who were unfruitful will become fruitful. And that may be what we should impose upon the understanding of this verse in chapter 32, the wilderness. Judgment shall dwell in the wilderness and righteousness remain in the fruitful field, meaning that judgment and righteousness will now be found among those that were fruitless before. Could be the Gentiles, or it could be Israel that has been made a wilderness by the judgments of God. And the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness shall be assurance and quietness and assurance forever. For my people shall dwell in peaceable habitation, in sure dwellings, in quiet resting places. Notice the images of the past few chapters brought together here. Assurance, quietness, resting places. All of these things come from the earlier passages like chapter 30, verse 15. In returning and rest shall be you be saved. In quietness and confidence shall be your strength. The idea is that what Hezekiah ought to do, trusting God and finding strength there, will be what the elect eventually do. When God establishes his new covenant and pours out his Spirit on his people, those who come into this covenant will experience this rest, will experience this safety and this security and this peace that he's actually trying to call his generation into, but they're not taking the bait. That the time will come after the judgments of God have transpired, mentioned in verses 9 through 14, that the time will come when God does pour out His Spirit on that believing remnant, which happened at the day of Pentecost. And those things which He's calling them to in His generation, which they're refusing, there will be some who do receive them and benefit from them. Now, chapter 33, we only have 10 minutes, but I don't want to make many comments about this. Let's take it. We need to cover the ground anyway. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. This is apparently spoken to the Assyrians, who came unprovoked and maliciously came and attacked nations and dealt treacherously with nations. God's saying, when you're finished doing that, when I'm finished with you doing that, I'm going to have that done to you too. It's the same thing that happened to you as you brought on others. O Lord, be gracious unto us. Isaiah prays, no doubt, as representative of the faithful remnant. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. When he says, we have waited for thee, as I said, I believe this must be Isaiah praying as a member of the faithful remnant within Jerusalem, saying, we, that is the faithful ones, the remnant, have waited for you. Be our salvation. At the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. As the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. This is how God will destroy the nations. Like caterpillars and locusts destroy a whole grain field by running back and forth and eating everything in sight, and they leave nothing standing. So that's how God's going to be when he scatters the nations. His destruction of them will be as complete as a locust invasion on a field of grain. And the Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. Now this, no doubt, is looking forward to that age that is described at the end of the previous chapter. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times, and strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. Behold, their valiant ones shall cry without. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceaseth. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the cities. He regardeth no man. The earth mourneth and languishes. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness. And Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. Now will I rise, saith the Lord. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself. Ye shall conceive chaff. Ye shall bring forth stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you. And the people shall be as the burnings of lime. As thorns cut up shall they be burned in the fire. Obviously, there's some parts of this that are a little difficult to know whether it's referring to the Assyrians still, as apparently in verse 1, or whether it's describing the judgment that would come on the Jews, which is described in some earlier passage. It's mostly the reference to Lebanon, Sharon, and Carmel, and Bashan in verse 9. Some of those are Palestinian regions, but Lebanon and Bashan, I believe, are outside of Palestine, so maybe it's just speaking of the judgment that comes upon all these Middle Eastern nations when the Assyrians are wiping them out. However, he talks about all these judgments that come as God being exalted. In verse 5 he says, the Lord is exalted. In verse 10 he says, now will I rise, saith the Lord, I will be exalted. In judgment he is exalted. There are currently many high things that exalt themselves against the knowledge of God, which the weapons of our warfare are intended to bring down. But God will ultimately be exalted himself by bringing them down. At this time, he seems to permit himself to be not exalted in the eyes of men, and allows others to exalt themselves above him, that the time will come when in judgment he exalts himself above them. Verse 13, hear, ye that are far off, what I have done, and ye that are near, acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of oppressions, that shakes his hands from holding bribes, that stops his ears from hearing of blood, and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil, he shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be the munitions of rocks. Bread shall be given to him. His water shall be sure. Thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty. They shall behold the land that is very far off. thine heart shall meditate terror. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver? Where is he that counted the towers? Thou shalt not see a fierce people, a people of deeper speech than thou canst perceive, and of a stammering tongue that thou canst not understand. Look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. But there the glorious Lord will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams, wherein shall no galley be with oars, neither shall the gallant ship pass thereby. For the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. He will save us. Thy tacklings are loosed, describing the enemy or the wicked as a ship, its tacklings are loose. They could not well strengthen their mast. They could not spread the sail. Then is the prey of the great spoil divided. The lame take the prey, and the inhabitants shall not say, I am sick. The people that dwell therein shall be forgiven their iniquity. Now, one of the difficulties about a passage like this, it seems to be a strange mixture of what would appear to be judgments, but also mentions of blessings. And sometimes the prophet seems to turn his attention to one audience, and then without notice turns for a moment to another audience and says something applicable to them, and then turns back to the other audience. One thing is relatively clear here. He's talking about the fact that the people in Zion, apparently referring to earthly Jerusalem in the case of verse 14, where it says, the sinners in Zion are afraid. That was the case in Isaiah's day. The people in Jerusalem, in Zion, were afraid because the Assyrians were around them. But he says that what they should really be afraid of is God, because God is a devouring fire. And who among us shall dwell with a devouring fire? Who among us can dwell with everlasting burnings? And, of course, we know from Hebrews that our God is a devouring fire, it says. And who can dwell with God is the question. And the question is asked elsewhere in the Scripture. For instance, in Psalm 15, where it's asked, you know, who can dwell in God's holy hill of Zion? And an answer is given there. Also in Psalm 24, another question like it. Who can stand in his holy place? Who can ascend to the hill of the Lord? These questions all have to do with who will be received in God's presence? Who will God allow to live with him? Who can ascend to his hill and dwell with him there? That's the same question that's asked here, only with a different slant. The idea is who can live with God, who happens to be a burning fire, who devours all wickedness? Well, the answer has got to be he that walks righteously and speaks uprightly. The way you live and the way you talk. He that despises the gain of oppressions, that is, he won't seek to get rich by oppressing the poor. He hates the very thought of it. He shakes his hands from holding bribes. If someone tries to hand him a bribe, he shakes his hands so he can't hold them. You know, he won't take them. He hates bribes. He hates oppressions. A man who's a righteous man, that person, he says, will dwell on high, verse 16. That person, verse 17, shall behold the beauty of the king. Yet they will live in the fear of the Lord, in verse 18. And then he says, you'll look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, verse 20. A quiet habitation, again, quietness, security, peace, is coming up again here in this passage. A tabernacle that shall not be taken down. This is a reference to a permanent tabernacle. This is not a reference to a physical building in Jerusalem. It's a reference to the church. And the image comes up previously.